Committee on Consumer and Business Affairs, meeting April 30th, 1987. We're here in Nevada, 1 o'clock.
While we're in recess, I should explain that I have two of my members that I just brought in.
She's got mad hope. That's why she called me back.
Anyway, I died laughing.
He didn't call me. Maybe I'll be the next one.
You ready? Okay. We do have a motion before us to send Ann Gross Senate Bill 88 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Teresa, please call the roll.
Ekis?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Schoon?
Aye.
McTeague?
Aye.
Gilman?
No.
Chair Gillen?
It's passed. Although this is somewhat in reverse, I would like you to address Representative Gilman's concerns.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Burkett, Administrator of the Aeronautics Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as you know, we introduced this bill through the pre-session filing process. And the main purpose for it being to, much as a renter of a car has a statement incorporated in the rental agreement regarding insurance and his ability or his, he can elect to waive the insurance coverage or do whatever he likes, we think that it's important to have people renting aircraft aware of what coverage may exist on that particular aircraft. And so they may elect to either get their own insurance to cover themselves or go somewhere else and rent an aircraft if the coverage is not adequate to suit them. In this day of insurance problems that we see really getting more complicated almost every day, we think that this is a reasonable bill. And we have talked to a number of both renters of aircraft and people who rent aircraft out, fixed base operators, and they have no problem at all with the concept of the bill.
Representative Gilman asked a question earlier. Why couldn't a person just ask?
Madam Chair and Representative Gilman, I presume they could. I presume they could get an honest answer or should get an honest answer, but they would have no evidence of that within the agreement that they've signed or are signing. We think it should be incorporated as a more formal process.
Representative Anderson?
The owner of a private aircraft, normally for their own business or pleasure, do they require some type of a certificate or any document when they rent the aircraft to some other individual or firm?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, you refer to an insurance, evidence of insurance?
No, just
they have...
You know, I guess the same thing if my own automobile. I guess, in theory, I could rent it to my neighbor for a vacation for a certain amount of money, I guess. I just wonder whether you had any control over were aircraft any different?
Representative Anderson, no. We have no control over that aspect of it. If an individual wants to rent his airplane that he owns to a friend, he can do so. However, he gets involved to some extent with the federal aviation regulations, and that becomes a commercial operation. And then there are a whole new set of regulations that come into play there. If he receives compensation for use of his aircraft above and beyond the expense of the operating costs, it's a different ballgame.
Well, that's what I thought I was trying to get at. There is a difference. Once you rent an aircraft, you come under different regulations. And that's why it's always a little fine line that we walk when my friend wants to take me to Canada fishing, you know, as to whether I'm going to be able to give him a gift or anything like that. It's a no-no. Otherwise, he falls under these other type of things. And I think there is a difference there. And if a person then is in the business of renting aircraft, I would think that person might need to be required to have that aircraft insured if somebody's out there flying it around.
Mm-hmm. One more question.
You bet, Representative.
Paul, take an airplane club as an example. How would this affect an airplane club, say at OSU?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, I think this would simply require no additional action on the part of an aero club. In other words, as I understand the way they operate, and OSU particularly, each of the people who use that airplane are considered to be part owners in the airplane. So,
then you feel they would be exempt from this law?
I do, yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is third.
Representative Schoonman and Representative Anderson. Yes.
If an aircraft that an individual did not rent, if there was no liability insurance on that aircraft, do you know of cases where the individual has been sued for the damages that might have incurred? And I'm asking, is it possible that the individual who's flying the aircraft would be sued in the absence of liability insurance on the aircraft itself?
Madam Chair and Representative Schoon, I am not aware personally of any specific cases of such kind.
If I may, there is an issue of suffocation in that if there is no insurance on that craft, under the law, that renter can be held liable. And there's another good reason for this legislation. Sherry?
Even if there is insurance,
mm-hmm. you can
if
still
the policy is written that subrogation is part of the policy, then the insurance company can come back on the renter to collect damages.
I'm going to move that this committee reconsider the vote by which this bill passed. And my intention is to add some language that addresses that issue and also give one of our members another shot at a vote.
Thank you.
Yes?
Mr. Burkett, in conversation yesterday, indicated that the Aeronautics Division would be willing to write that into the rules, that the subrogation issue be disclosed, if that happens to be the case. Wanted to make you aware of that conversation of yesterday. Rather than have it in statute, the division would be willing to write that into rule.
Madam Chair, we've discussed this with our Assistant Attorney General, and he feels that by incorporating it, if we could incorporate it in our form,
mm-hmm.
which we're required to provide by the statute.
We've got your commitment.
Just a check off saying it is subrogated or is not. But then the individual will know whether that applies.
Okay. We have your commitment to address that.
Yes, Madam Chair, you
Thank
do.
You. Teresa, please call the roll.
Ekus?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
P. Peterson?
Aye.
Schoon?
Aye.
McTeague?
Aye.
Gilman?
Aye.
Chair Jolin?
Aye. Senate Bill 88A engrossed is now up for reconsideration. And just to expedite the process, Representative Ekus moves Senate Bill 88A engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, is
yes.
The other member in the hallway, or are we going to worry about that?
Our other member is right there.
Oh, there he is.
I'm pretty good at keeping my eye on you, folks. Teresa, please call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Schoon?
Aye.
McTeague? Gilman?
Aye.
Ekus?
Aye.
Chair Jolin?
Aye. Senate Bill 88A engrossed is passed to the floor. Representative Ekus, would you like to carry the bill? Actually, I should have asked Representative Gilman. Would you like to carry the bill?
I would, sure.
Thank you very much, Representative. Close the work session on Senate Bill 88.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 145. We did not have any amendments on this bill.
Well, this bill prohibits certain kinds of commodity contracts, and if you recall, was explained section by section, I believe it was a week ago, in the public hearing.
Sounds like it's a pretty good consumer bill.
Cross your fingers.
At least we pray that so.
I did look up the Senate vote if you're interested.
Did we have any amendments?
What was the Senate? No, we did not have any amendments.
The Senate vote was unanimous on the floor.
Of course, that does not give us necessarily any indication. The Senate is quite different from the House in many instances. I would encourage.
Madam Chair,
yes.
This is the one that required them to had to actually deposit the gold and other things.
Yes, I think so. We've got Ms. Day in here, don't we?
Yes.
Why don't you folks come on down?
We actually
this
have
is
to
the issue that we
deliver the commodity before the contract is valid and mm-hmm. into a deposit institution.
Did you hear his question?
Not specifically, Madam Chair.
Do you want to repeat your question?
Well, it wasn't really a question. I was just running through my mind trying to remember the bill. This was the legislation that required delivery or deposit of the commodity that was purchased before the contract is actually valid.
Madam Chair, Representative Ekus.
Please let us know who you're on.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Brooks with the Securities Corporation Division. Madam Chair, Representative Ekus. It's a little bit in reverse. It is what you say. Excluded from the definition of commodity contracts that are covered by this bill are those contracts where the gold is delivered to a depository within 7 days from the purchase.
Yes, Representative Schoon.
I move the bill to the public due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Any further comments or questions? If not, Teresa, please call the roll.
McTeague?
Aye.
Gilman?
Aye.
Ekus?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Schoon?
Aye.
Chair Jolin?
Aye. The bill is passed to the floor with a due pass. Representative Ekus?
This one?
Yes.
Okay.
I tried to give you the easy one. Actually, this is, I think this is a good piece of legislation. Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill, or the work session, pardon me, on Senate Bill 145.
When I spoke on the telephone solicitation bill, I got a rug. I wonder if I'm going to get a piece of gold.
That would be nice. Oh, 148. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 148. Do we have anybody? Why don't you come on down? Refresh our memories. And please let us know who you are, although I know who you are. Some people may not.
I'm Tommy Gash. I'm the supervisor of the Savings and Loan Credit Union and Consumer Finance Section of the Financial Institutions Division. Senate Bill 148 is basically a housekeeping bill that we're making some corrections to the legislation. I didn't bring a copy of it because I thought we were talking on 146 today.
David, Dave, can you give us a little recap? Is that possible on this bill?
On the bill you have before that? Mm-hmm. We have one section in it that's repealed by the act, and that's our only interest in the bill.
Okay.
I really can't stop.
I've got a copy now.
Okay. Yes, Representative Schoon. Thank you. Any further comment or questions? Teresa, please call the roll.
Peterson?
Aye.
Schoon?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Ekus?
Aye.
Gilman?
Aye.
McTeague?
I guess.
Jolin?
Aye. The bill is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. For fear of possibly overloading you, will you carry the bill? Thank you. Schoon will carry the bill. Okay. No, we don't have 146 today. Now we will enter the work session on House Bill 3284. Representative Peterson Anderson.
We need a recess, ma'am.
All right. We shall have you, 10 minutes?
We're trying to hand engross it at Mancare. No one can make head or tail without hand engrossing it. It's being done now, and I would suspect the very earliest is going to be, I'm sorry to tell you this, but about 45 minutes. The job started about 20 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Now, Representative Peterson, what do you think?
Would you like to?
That's my preference. We've gone through so many changes and so many compromises. It's going to be hard to follow. It could be we can move it up a little earlier than that.
Try for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, just for a moment, close the work session on HB 3284. And reopen the work session on Senate Bill 148. And I would move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 148 to the floor. Teresa, please, or Pam, wrong person, please call the roll.
Okay, Representatives Peterson?
Aye.
Schoon? Ekus?
Aye.
Gilman? McTeague?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Jolin?
Aye. It is reconsidered. We neglected to plug in some amendments in the bill. Thursdays just aren't good days, I'm convinced.
I'll move the amendments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative McTeague. Noted as Commerce, Senate Bill 148. They have
Madam
been
Chair.
Moved. Yes, Representative Anderson.
I assume these are right. They're not a mess.
I think that they're so basic that we'll have no problems. Teresa, please call the roll.
Peterson?
Aye.
Schoon? Anderson?
Aye.
Ekus?
Aye.
Gilman? McTeague?
Aye.
Chair Dolan.
Aye. The amendments have been passed.
Madam Chair, I intend to ask for unanimous consent when the other members return to vote on the bill.
Oh, okay. Okay. As a matter of fact, we can hold off on the vote and wait for the other members, if you choose, instead of going through all that procedure. Let's close the work session on Senate Bill 148 and reopen the work session on House Bill 3284. Okay, we need Andy. You want to go to the podium? I should say Representative Anderson and Representative Peterson.
Okay, Chairman.
Hal Martin. Thank you, Andy. Let's see, Mary Lynn. And Felicia, I'd like you to begin just by noting your intent as in regard to the fiscal impact statement. Yeah, just let Felicia address that, and then we'll get together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Felicia Trader, Deputy Secretary of State. It's our understanding, based on the work of the subcommittee and the intent of the amendments as currently proposed, that the registration procedure will be the same as it is right now, coming from the 85 legislation. And with that understanding, we'd like to withdraw our fiscal impact report because there are no additional requirements that were in this bill as proposed. And we have received an additional staff position in this year's budget to administer the prearranged funeral plan portion that's in our budget. So there will be no additional impact to us, and we'd like to withdraw that fiscal impact report.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. That makes our job easier.
Okay.
Why don't you folks all come on down?
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Nancy Peterson. And Andy will want to speak to this too, but we met with about 12 people, worked through several major issues in here, came to some agreement, and then after the fact decided one thing perhaps hadn't been or couldn't be resolved. So we're not necessarily all on board today, but I'd like Mary Lynn to sort of take us through the bill, and anyone who feels a need to comment or ask questions, do so. And see if we can understand the bill, because it's gone through so many, you know, representations or amendments or whatever. And I think that might be the best bet.
Andy. Representative Anderson.
Representative Andy Anderson, for the record. Madam Chair, I think Representative Peterson said it all. I'm not really sure where we're hung out on this one in particular, but I believe that when we shortly and hopefully get a hand engrossed version that does verify our discussion today, that we may be able to move the bill.
Thank you. And before I go to you, Mary Lynn, I want to thank both representatives for participating in what I understand was a very interesting
You may meeting. Not want to thank us after we're done today.
Mary Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Lynn Messer from the Association of Funeral Service Professionals. If I may, I'll just start on the first pages and only expand on the pages where there's some substantial amendments of the bill.
Do we have
from the original bill?
As we speak. Representative McTeague, do you have a copy of the amendments?
That's the next one.
Again, we are working as we speak at this very moment on fully engrossing the bill. But rather than to wait until that is completed, we decided to just move forward. Please continue.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm working from the original bill and reading off the amendments of HB 3284-18. On the first page, lines 1 and 2 and 3, what you're doing is you're reinserting existing statute, existing ORS 128 128.412 and 128.414 and 128.990 and ORS 692.285. What this is going to do is reinstate the existing statute on endowment care cemeteries, and it will reinstate the existing statute on the regulation and the auditing of a certified person selling prearranged funeral plans. The only other amendment on that page is line 19, where you will change the board. Line two will be deleted, because now the Secretary of State will be doing the certification process, which is the way it's current in current statute. So that line is being deleted.
May I interrupt? Marilyn, could you explain at this point why we're leaving out endowment care cemeteries, what the implications of that are?
Okay. Existing statute on endowment care cemeteries allows for the percentage of trusting at 66 2/3 for vaults and markers, and on pre-construction 35% is what must be trusted. The reason why we didn't try to encompass that in our bill is because as we move down, what we have done with our bill, we're going to have two kinds of contracts now, basically. We're going to have one, it's called a 90% guaranteed contract, 90% trusting, and 100% non-guaranteed contract. To try to encompass the endowment care statute, in which you're allowed to take 33 1/3 for vaults and markers, and 65 for pre-construction, we didn't have any way of trying to encompass that in the 90% contract and 100% trusting. So we said, rather than try to even deal with that and have 5 or 6 different kinds of sections and packages in here, to just leave the endowment care the way it was, any cemetery merchandise, vaults, markers, caskets, which is funeral merchandise, that's sold through a non-endowed cemetery will now fall into either a 90 or 100% contract. Did I muddy the water?
Everybody all right?
I think we're coming.
And that's the reason why we put back the statute, existing statute on endowment care. On page 2 of the bill, line 30, we remove the language and endowment care cemetery contributions, because again, we're not talking about them anymore. Section 4 and 5 of page 2, all of page 3 and all of page 4 are being deleted. On page 5, delete lines 1 through 27. What you just have deleted is all the certification and regulation, the new language, and we are going back at the end of these amendments and putting back the existing statute. Section 12.
Excuse me, Mary Lynn, will you tell us why we're doing that again?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the reason we're doing that is because primarily, several reasons. The Federal Trade Commission, along with the AG's office, said that perhaps we're getting a little too severe in our regulation here with our existing statute, and that the existing law that we worked on in 1985, along with OFDA, seems to be working quite accurately. And when you dealt with that and the confusion of the rest, we said, let's just go back to the existing statute. It seems to be working properly. There's no major concerns out there that have been happening, and that's primarily the reason why we removed that. There will be no additional funding. There will be no additional fiscal. There should be no fiscal impacts, because we're not requiring now anything different that was done previously.
Faith yesterday and put a lot of things back into it. Respect to the chair, we do have a problem, and as I represent 112, I think, small businesses, and that group can make those decisions. The proponents of the bill can make those decisions real quickly. I can't do that. Had we been able to solve that one problem about the authorship of the bill, then we could have made that decision today. In visiting with Representative Anderson, he's, if I remember right, he said that we would have a few days before that hit the floor, so they could, we could meet with the leaders of my profession and still maybe have an opportunity to do that.
Let me give you an idea. First of all, this is going to have to be engrossed and printed. And if I may look to the administrator for some advice, that's probably going to take a couple of days in itself, or at least a day.
It'll be about 7 days before it's on the floor.
About 7 days before it hits the floor. And all you need do, even if it were that day before the bill was heard, the motion to add your organization's name to this bill would not occur until the, hopefully, passage of the bill. So I think that will give you time, whether you have to use the phone or the mails,
right,
to make contact with your members, let them know of the fact that this is a considerably different bill than from where we began.
I can tell you, Madam Chair, that the people in this room who I represent agree with the bill. We have represent a lot of people, and we need to make sure that they're involved in the decision-making process, too. And that will give us ample time to come back with a letter stating one way or the other whether we would like to get on the bill and support it or not. I'd like to go on record again once more saying thanking the committee for letting us share our views, and especially Representative Peterson and Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I think we've got a section that was in the engrossed version that came late that we hadn't talked about. Representative Anderson, do you want to? It's on page 5 of the engrossed version that you just received. We didn't start with this version until page 10, so we need to back up and talk about that section. Marilyn?
What this will do is we have some language in here that's being deleted, which will allow factoring in the sale of contracts. That was not the intent of the drafters. What we wanted was that in the event of business is sold, that the contracts could also go with the new owner, the new funeral director, if it may be. What the language on page 5 will allow for this to occur. It says a successor trustee is a depository as defined in Section 3 of this Act, or the original trustee has ceased selling or offering to sell prearranged sales contracts or pre-construction sales contracts, has surrendered a certificate of registration or registration under ORS 692.285, and the successor trustee holds a certificate of registration or is registered under ORS 692.285.
I'm not so sure that does it. I'm not so sure. I know that we are saying the same things and we're trying to accomplish it, but I'm not sure that this particular wording actually, the objective was if a new owner, correct me if I'm wrong, if a new owner came in and bought a new mortuary, and that's happening all the time, mm-hmm, now, do they automatically take over and are responsible for the trust accounts? And I'm certainly not an attorney, but I'm not comfortable with it.
Representative,
I just wanted to throw one more bolt into the machine work here a little bit, regarding this same subject. When Mary Lynn was describing contract purchasers, I thought of a contract purchaser as a contract purchaser, somebody was purchasing a contract. And so I went back and read this and reread it, and on page 7 up the top of the handout was copy in line 20. 22, line 22, the words contract purchaser and then or purchaser's estate are used. And I think that actually they're talking about the beneficiary. However, the purchaser of the services, not the contract purchaser, but the purchaser of the services could be someone different. But the purchaser is not defined. The beneficiary is. And if there's any possibility that this could, in fact, it's absolutely wrong the way it's written.
I agree.
Yes.
And as it's written here, the contract purchaser, who would be the, as Mary Lynn just got through talking about this, person who buys the contract would be the recipient of the extra cash. So I think this is another thing that either needs, I think a purchaser needs to be defined in the definition section, because the purchaser need not be the beneficiary, and I see it could be, but not necessarily. But if we're going to describe the purchaser as somebody who does something or gets something, It ought to be, I think, defined and not described as a contract purchaser.
If I may, we are trying to get Mr. Reitlinger, or I can't pronounce his name.
Reitlinger.
Reitlinger?
Or you can say Reitlinger.
People What's his first name?
Ted.
Ted. We are trying to get Ted down here to address that particular issue. And also, he can address maybe some of your concerns in that language that is in here. Let me get the word from Teresa. So she
Madam Chair, while we're waiting for the...
What would it work?
Da. You can't begin talking without identifying yourself. We need to know
come
who
up
you
so
are.
You can hear,
Wayne Musgrove.
Why don't you come up a little closer? Or at least approach that mic, maybe. Either way you want to do it.
Wayne Musgrove, OFDA. I wonder if we could just put in there the contract purchaser or the beneficiary of the contract. That would be the person that is being buried. And that's the way a lot of those contracts are written. Someone comes in and makes a contract for their father. The beneficiary of the contract is the father. He's the one that's being buried, and the son is the one that's doing the purchasing. I don't know if that settles that or not, but under almost all circumstances, that would.
No. I don't think that settles it. Representative Schoon?
I think you've got the idea that a contract purchaser is different than the purchaser of the services.
Okay. We need to get a legal opinion on this.
Okay.
Is frankly, my intention, and I've shared this with others, is once we put this bill together, I am certainly, as the chair of this committee, going to tell the Senate hands off. Whether that works or not, I don't know, but that's what I'm going to tell them. Simply because there have been many, many hours, and finally we've come to a point where we've gotten some agreement where all interested parties have participated. And I really feel that we've got a good piece of legislation here.
Yeah, I'd like to see council to take care of it on the evening.
We're waiting. Yes.
I'd like to share you maybe. Wasn't legislative council going to bring us in another small little draft of this addition that we put in here about how you sell out the whole shooting match? Or were they just going to take this hand?
I believe this is it. What happened with the in respect to sale of the contracts with sale of the business is that was left out of the new amendments inadvertently. I mean, it was part of the request, but it was overlooked. So council quickly drafted this by hand just so you'd have something to work with and it wouldn't be just completely conceptual. But it doesn't look to me like this really addresses the point still that the committee is after.
Well, we need to wait for...
I might suggest that we can move on some of these minor changes that we've made while we're...
We certainly can do that. Would you folks like to return to the...
Sure.
To your proper places? Yes, sir? Please.
Madam Chair, my name is Ross Labor, and I'm with the Attorney General's office. Mm-hmm. And I just had one thing I wanted to draw to the committee's attention, and particularly have Mary Lynn comment on it. I'm not sure the language here corresponds to what the intent of the meeting was yesterday. If you would go to the top of, well, first of all, to page 6 of the engrossed version. My concern here is the issue of distribution. When a funeral home actually provides the services, you will see that it originally referred to, it's been marked out now, Section 2 talks about the principal and the undistributed income. We no longer have really undistributed income. We just have income because we've eliminated the provision to allow for the withdrawal of any interest. In Sub 2, it tells us that we can, if the services are provided, that the principal can be withdrawn and paid to the funeral home who provides the services. The issue then becomes what happens to the interest. And if you would go to the next page, the top of 7, Sub 3, I believe, is intended to deal now with the situation of what happens to the interest, because it says, upon the payment of the to the certified person of the principal in trust under subsection 2. Then we have the undistributed income of the trust shall be paid to. You know, first of all, I question whether that should still be undistributed, because now we're just talking about all of the income. A, the certified person who sold the contract, if the contract is a guaranteed contract. In that case, you would, in effect, be paying all of the interest.
Excuse me, just a moment. I'd like Ted to follow us on this. We're on page 7.
Okay. Is 7 line, referring to now lines particularly 17 through 23. As I read this, where the services are performed, on line 20 now, under the guaranteed contract, we would pay all of the interest to the certified person, which I think is appropriate. They perform the services, they would then get all of the interest. However, in line 22 and 23, where we have a non-guaranteed contract, it says that all of the interest, as I read this going back up to the top, will be paid to the contract purchaser or the purchaser's estate. And I don't think that's the intent in a non-guaranteed contract situation. That would essentially mean that you perform for just the principal, unless you're going to turn around and, I guess, bill. You know, I suppose you could pay them the interest and then turn around and have them pay you back the difference, as Representative Anderson was describing that situation, which, you know, possibly, I suppose, could do it.
Yeah. Mary Lynn, why don't you respond to that?
If I may, Madam Chair, I believe that that was the intent. It's that at the time of delivery, only the principal will go to the certified seller. And the interest goes to the purchaser or buyer or benefit or estate. Now, if there's going to be additional charges, if the services and merchandise that were purchased in the contract, if that principal no longer covers those charges, then the certified seller can go back to the buyer or consumer or beneficiary and say, you now have to either pay me some more of that interest or pay it out of your own pocket, or however you want to do it. But that, I believe, was the intent, and that's why we were dealing with it. Just simplified it and with distribution of the interest, rather than say the interest will go to the certified seller, and then if the cost doesn't cover, then. And that's the reason for that. But yes, in fact, if there's more money due, then the purchaser has to pay the certified seller.
Ted, while I just have a moment, I understand you stayed here late last night preparing all of these amendments. And I want to say before this audience and God and this committee that I really appreciate that. And I realize, too, that you folks aren't paid any overtime. And so you, I don't know whether you did it out of the goodness of your heart, but I want you to know that I appreciate that, and I'm sure the members of this committee do, and I want to acknowledge that. Another question we have falls on page 5 of that Hann and Gross bill. And Mary Lynn, again, will you repeat what we were trying to do, and let's see how you had a question of if, in fact, we were accomplishing that.
I believe the intent here is to allow for a successor funeral director, someone who's buying a business, to be able to take over those contracts, to somehow take them and honor them. We had some language within our original bill that was not acceptable to some members and some people, so we've deleted that and asked legislative council to come up with some form of language which would allow that. And whether or not this was appropriate.
And we're asking you, Ted, what this language, does this language address that properly or not?
Madam Chair, for the record, Ted Reutlinger, legislative council. When I drafted this very quickly, it was intended to cover all situations and not just a situation where you have a funeral director selling a business, because as we've defined person in this act, it can be somebody other than a licensee under Chapter 692. Therefore, I tried to draft it so that it would cover anybody who has received a certificate to sell these pre-arrangement plans, to transfer that trustee responsibility if they no longer are certified and no longer in the business of selling those types of plans. And that's what this language was intended to do. It was intended to cover everybody who holds a certificate or is registered to sell those things.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, we're talking about two different subject matters here, and that is that the trustee being able to move those funds to a successor trustee, which is her depository. This language relates to you're moving your trust accounts from one depository to another because you're benefiting from higher interest rates. I thought what we were trying to accomplish is to make sure that a new funeral home owner was going to take over those deposits, wherever the depository is. This is a different subject altogether. We're not talking about the same things here. And also, I'm not positive about the wording on A, the successor trustee is a depository. I believe under the pre-need laws, as I understand them, the depository is not the trustee at all. They're merely the depository and not the trustee. Isn't that true? Here's a bunch of
interest. Ted's shaking his head, yes.
Yeah.
Do you understand what we're trying to achieve, and apparently we're not achieving it with this language? Is it clear in your mind?
Not particularly. Is it that you're trying to accomplish, if the trustee is just a funeral home, for example, and that business is sold to another person,
mm-hmm.
transferring mm-hmm. the trustee responsibility from the original trustee
mm-hmm.
to...
Right.
Okay, what about the situation where a person is certified with the Secretary of State under this bill and is not a business of any kind, say, that has a license under 692 or any other statute? Is it possible for the certified person to be something other than... a funeral service practitioner?
I believe that Secretary of State can certainly address that, but I think you cannot have a certificate to sell pre-need unless you are a funeral home. I think that is in the name of the funeral home rather than a person, I believe. So you don't have the issue of a certified person, as an example, who doesn't have a funeral home but has trust accounts. I don't think that's the issue.
Representative Schoon.
On page 3 of the Hannah Gross bill, it defines trustee and it includes as a successor trustee at least a depository. So if that ever occurred, then the trustee would be a depository.
Excuse me, Representative Schoon, what line are you on?
Line 35, the original wording on page 3 of the Hannah Gross copy.
Trustee means a certified person sold a pre-arrangement sales contract or pre-construction sales contract when the depository appointed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I do know as a layperson in the banking industry that the banks are not trustees of the funeral plans. There are some trusts evidently in the cemetery field, you have trust companies and trust departments of banks managing endowment accounts, but you do not in the cemetery. I mean, in the prearranged funeral plan area, the bank is only the depository. They are not the trustee.
Okay. Well, I need some direction here. We all do. Again, I'm going to ask the question. I'm going to be redundant. But does this language take care of what we are trying to do or not?
Madam Chair, the way I read it in our bill, in the existing statute, the trustee is clearly defined as the certified seller. And the sections that we're talking about on page 6, subsection 8 and 9, 7, 8, and 9, it allows the trustee to go to a depository and say, depository, do you want to be the trustee? It just allows for it. It doesn't mandate. It allows for that successor trustee transfer. Is the way that I believe that we've drafted. A trustee may appoint a successor depository, means they may take their money out from one and put it in another, or they may solicit a depository to become the trustee, and if the depository so chooses, they may do that. With the language that Ted has drafted here on page 5, subsection 9, it says an original trustee may appoint a successor trustee, and I believe if we say the successor trustee can be a depository defined in Section 3 of this Act, mm-hmm. or, and now what we're talking about here in the next section is if the trustee goes out of business, is no longer selling or offering prearranged sales contracts or pre-construction, he surrendered his certificate of registration, he can now appoint an accessor trustee who holds a certificate of registration or is registered under ORS 692.285. That means I'm reading this now to say, and I may be incorrect, but this is what I'm reading is saying that you as trustee, if you no longer want to be in the business and want to sell it, you can sell it, but you can only sell it to someone who's registered and certified. Or you may select to go to depository and say, depository, do you want to be the trustee?
I can tell you they do not.
Well,
the banks require prearranged, not cemetery services, not that, but on the funeral side, the banks do not want to be the trustee.
Well, this language would not mandate it. It just would have
that's
an option.
That's the point I was going to make, and I think we're clouding the issue. That's my sense of this now. I'm beginning to focus in and understand. This is permissive language in that if that's out there, you're covered. If there's ever an instance where this does occur, you've got the language to tighten it up, secure it, and cover it.
And I'll take your word for that, I'm sure.
And also now, in thrashing this through my mind, I believe that the answer to my question is yes. This addresses those concerns of yours.
Madam Chair, I disagree with that. This language has anything to do with someone purchasing the funeral at all? I think it has any bearing on whether, when you purchase a funeral home, are you going to purchase the and take over the existing trust? This is addressed the current trust account. It allows the successor trustee as a depository. You can leave that in if you want to, but we've dealt with banks for a long time. They don't want to be the depository. I don't have any problem with the language. Our objective to start this section here at the meeting yesterday, and correct me if I'm wrong, was to allow a successor purchaser of a funeral home to take over the trust accounts. My opinion yesterday, and as is today, we didn't need any language. That is an asset of the business. If you go on, that's been going on for years. If you go buy a funeral, you buy the coach, you buy the flowers, you buy the existing structure, the trust accounts go with it. I mean,
well, then my question to you would be, why do you need additional language?
I never really think we did.
Okay, but this would not affect that.
No, there's nothing to do with it at all.
Uh huh. But this is further language that tightens up a potential scenario that could occur. I think I am. Representative
Madam
Peterson.
Chair, I might just comment on the discussion that we had yesterday, that clearly that is what we were looking for, language that would allow the sale of a funeral home and everything that went with it. We did have some discussion that was probably already the way it would happen in law anyway. Now, as I understood we were drafting language to further clarify that. I'm not sure that it does. I am of the argument at this point that we don't need this language, that there's sufficient law already. Now, I'd appreciate if Marilyn would comment on that, but I think, although this does deal with something else, I'm not convinced that we need it.
Madam Chair.
Just one moment. Representative Schoon.
I think that we should let Legislative Council give Legislative Council time to look at this whole idea of who the trustee is, what the trust is, what the contract is, and all the ramifications of it, because I believe that a trust is not an asset of the business. And if you look at the definition, it says that it's a trust created whereby a trustee has certain responsibilities. That trust is not an asset of the business. If the money is being held in trust for the benefit of the purchaser of the service, who is also called the beneficiary in some cases. So it's not an asset of the business, and it would not go with the business, although the contract might.
Okay, what if...
You know, if it were written that way.
What if, Representative Schoon and others, if we were to come up with some language, whether it's needed or not, but for our own state of mind in a positive sense, that made it clear that under these circumstances that trust would be an asset, be considered an asset of the business?
Well, I don't think you can do that. I mean, it's not an asset of the business, and therefore you can't make
it. In many cases, it's a liability when it's only 90%.
That's right, it's a liability. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But I think that we're mixing this all up. And in fact, earlier, one of the parties to this said that, for example, that the funds, could, once they're deposited, could never be moved. And now I'm hearing that they could be moved. I just heard that about 10 minutes ago. And so I don't think there's a clear understanding of the parties that are involved as to what the trust is or what the depository is. And I think the Legislative Council, if just given a little bit of time to go through this, could pick out the things that are wrong with it. And I think that us trying to write this here as we are doing, we know what we want to do, so do they know what they want to do. But I think maybe we should give Legislative Council the ideas that we want and let them review it for correctness.
Madam Chair,
just a moment, please. How quickly can you do that?
As quickly as you need it.
I'd like to complete this issue today. We have spent a lot of time on this issue, as much or more than 2451 that finally will be reaching the floor. And frankly, the speaker has been after me to get rid of these House bills, and her patience is wearing thin. As a matter of fact, the last word was that for the most part, unless there was a priority bill, and we will be having one of those, it's mine, we needed to move these out by the end of the month, and that's where we're sitting right now. How quickly could you address the concerns? Yes, Representative
I'd like to go back to the question that I raised, too, that purchaser is not defined in here, and yet we keep referring to the purchaser
and
a contract purchaser, which appear to be two different things.
Page 7, Ted.
Whether it was intended to be or not.
Page 7. Lines, what is it, 17 to 23, and specifically line 22, sub B, the contract